Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Message from Oslo to Brussels. Thanks, but no thanks. Norwegians vote to stay out of the European Union, though many reasons are given to explain the vote. Environmental protection is perhaps the strongest. Also this time, Operation Desert Water. The mission? Refill the Dead Sea.
One of the options that has been suggested for increasing the total amount of water supply in the region is to dig a canal, some sort of canal, some sort of pipeline, either from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, or from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Norwegians said, no way. Norway becomes the only European nation so far to turn down a plan to join the newly forming European Union. Bucking a worldwide trend seen in the North American Free Trade Agreement, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the Asian Pacific Economic Community, APEC, a move to create huge trading blocks worldwide, bucking this trend, 52.3% of those voting in Norway decided to remain free and independent. The vote reflected a number of concerns, including some very strong environmental protection concepts. Bjørn Konevin, director of Norwegian information at the Norwegian consulate in New York City, says the vote was divided, with urban areas voting yes to join, rural and fishing communities voting not to join.
I think part of the reason for this attitude outside of the urban centers lies in the fact that Norway has traditionally followed a policy of support to outlying districts. We feel it's very important that our population can remain relatively well distributed over the whole country. It's important for people to be able to make a good livelihood also in outlying districts, both in order to use the whole land and use all of our resources, but also in order to populate the whole country. We're far up north, and it's easy for Norway to become a country which would be relatively barren, most of it.
And how did they feel generally then in voting no by 52.3%? How did they feel that particular structure, political and economic structure, would be threatened by joining the European community?
My interpretation of that is that the distance to Oslo can sometimes seem great when you live in a local community with very specific concerns for your livelihood where you live. And the distance to Brussels was just seen as that much greater. I don't think that there was a very thorough analysis of what possibilities Norway would have within the Union to follow the same positive policies for the districts. I don't think that really was analyzed. It was more an emotional vote to say that Oslo is remote enough. We don't need to involve an even more remote place like Brussels, seen from a Norwegian valley or an island off the coast.
And Norway, of course, is blessed with a great many rich resources, oil fields off the coast. You've got a very rich and thriving, prosperous, and sustaining fishing industry, and a good, healthy agricultural system that supplies a great deal of Norwegian food at the supermarket and on the tables. What was some of the ecological concerns, or is there an ecological element in this vote by 52.3% voting no? Was there any interpretation by the coastal communities, for example, in the fishing industry, having to do with an ecological reasoning behind voting no?
Very much so. You're absolutely correct in pointing out the fact that we do have rich resources, and I'm sure that for many, maintaining control over those resources was a major factor in their decision. But even A more powerful factor, I think, is in the lessons that we have learned in how to utilize our resources in a sustainable way. And our fishing industry is a very good case in point. We've been through the overfishing. We've been through situations where the fishermen simply took too much. And they have learned that they need to be quite rigorous in their management procedures on how the fishing is conducted in order to make our stocks of fish plentiful so that we have something for the future also. And that was very much a concern for those voting no to a membership, because they were afraid that we would not be able to maintain the management system that we have over our natural resources.
More specifically, what were some of the specific concerns then, if by joining the European community, how would this stability, let's say just in the fishing industry, how would that stability have been threatened or at least changed by having to merge and cooperate with nations on the continent?
The worry was that countries with a large fishing industry that are looking for new stocks to fish from, such as Spain and Portugal, that their fleets would gain access to the fishing grounds off the Norwegian coast, and thereby disturb the delicate balance between the quotas set and the stocks and the growth of the stocks. For instance, on this side of the Atlantic, there is very little cod left, and certainly the Canadian cod fishing on this side of the Atlantic has for the most part stopped, whereas on our side the cod stocks are in healthy growth and our fishing quotas are on the increase. So there was a worry that there would be too many players, so to speak, in the same on the same grounds. Now, whether that worry was well-founded or not, that's another issue, but I think it certainly played a major role in the way our fishermen voted.
Conovan says this environmental protectionist interpretation of the no vote can be applied to other industries as well, oil and gas, timber and agriculture. In fact, during the days leading up to the vote, there was strong linkage between the environment and the voting booth.
One of the main slogans during the campaign from the no side was yes to environmental protection, no to membership in the EU. Some of us, like myself, felt that that was a misguided statement, because some of us voted yes to membership because of environmental reasons also. But I think it's important to note that in Norway, for any politician to be elected to any office, that politician needs to show a strong environmental attitude. Go to an election, for instance, with the suggestion that we might need to increase our gas tax even more in order to achieve a better quality of life. That's something that a politician would be helped by in a Norwegian election. I think that's not the case here. So there's the whole sense of the importance of the environment and the importance of our quality of life is very ingrained in Norwegian politics.
Mr. Conovan, let me ask you. Your Prime Minister, Gro Brundtland, is one of the world's leading political ecologists. I think most would agree, no matter what side of the aisle, so to speak, you would be sitting on, to recognize her leadership work over the years. However, the Norwegian whaling industry has been under fire in recent years for continuing to hunt whale when most nations are cutting back or eliminating altogether as a result of a sort of a global agreement about this. How does this square with, as you've expressed, these concerns otherwise for ecological preservation?
Your question is very pertinent because it points to the difference between what's popular and what is based on scientific principles. In the case of whaling, the Norwegian whaling is conducted under exactly the same principles of sustainable management that is guiding our policies with regard to all other resources. And that's why the stocks that are being hunted in Norway are only stocks that are plentiful. And so therefore, for our Prime Minister, there was no reason to take a different point of view. There was no reason to create a holy cow, so to speak, with regard to the minke whale, which is the stock that that we take. Of course, that point of view is not very popular because there are so many whale species that are threatened. And I don't think that there's sufficient understanding of the fact that some whale species are in fact plentiful, whereas many are threatened. And we certainly participate in protecting those that need protection.
If many who voted no did so for ecological reasons, Condovan says there were those who voted yes to join the union, also for ecological reasons. Citing just one example, he says the argument there is quite simple.
Air pollution doesn't recognize national borders and therefore needs to be addressed in an international context.
Bjørn Condovan, director of Norwegian information at the Norwegian consulate in New York City. He says it is not likely Norwegians will ever vote again on this issue, thus becoming the first nation in the world to turn down a trading treaty for environmental reasons. This is Bruce Robertson. To order a cassette copy of today's program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 258. That's 1-800-747-7444. The Environment Show, program number 258. After millions of years, the Dead Sea is in danger of becoming, in fact, dead, dried up and blown away. Lying 1,300 feet below sea level, the Dead Sea is fed by the Jordan River. Until modern times, the Jordan supplied enough water to replace the amount evaporating under the blazing desert sun in the Middle East. With rapid expansion of population and industrial activity in the region, the Jordan has been dammed, channeled, and diverted upstream by Syria, Jordan, and Israel, leaving only a small stream to enter the Dead Sea. Recent political peace agreements in the region are now making it possible for engineers to press forward with a plan of action. The idea is to, well, Dr. Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute in Oakland, California, reviews the plan.
One of the options that has been suggested for increasing the total amount of water supply in the region is to dig a canal, some sort of pipeline, either from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea or from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea. And the major advantage of this would be that the Dead Sea is very low. It's well below sea level. And so if you run water from either the Mediterranean or the Dead Sea, which are at sea level, down to the Dead Sea, you can generate electricity through the drop. You're basically dropping water quite a distance, over about 350 meters, and you can produce electricity with that water. Now, there have been some ideas recently that you could then use that electricity to run a desalination plant, which requires a tremendous amount of energy to desalinate water, and you could desalinate some of the water that you're bringing in, thereby producing some additional fresh water for the region, for Israel, for Jordan, for the Palestinians.
Now, this idea has been talked about for a while now, and with the recent peace accords being signed nation by nation in the area, it may or may not be closer to happening than before. What is the status of these discussions for whichever canal would be dug, either from the Mediterranean or up from the Red Sea?
It has been talked about for a long time in different forms. In some ways, it's an engineer's dream, and there are many, many questions about whether or not it ought to be built. And there are many different configurations that have been proposed. There are three different paths that you might bring water from the Mediterranean down to the Dead Sea. The Jordanians somewhat lean toward the Red Sea-Dead Sea connection because, of course, the Red Sea is much closer to them, and it would be easier for them to make use of the fresh water that could be produced. But there have been no real feasibility studies done on either the economics or the environmental impacts. I would say that there's no real leading contender right now for which, if any of these projects might be built.
Well, let's discuss sort of broadly speaking then. Where would the, of the different options, let's say the Mediterranean Sea mm-hmm. to the Dead Sea Canal, of any of the options that are being discussed, where would some, how would this, what would it actually look like, say, from, a satellite photo or even from, an air picture? What would it look like? Where would it come from and how would it get to the Dead Sea?
Well, there are a couple of proposals. The basic idea, though, is that you either dig a canal or a pipeline, build a pipeline, or probably some combination of the two, from the Mediterranean that would take a fairly large volume of water from the ocean, from the sea there, run it across the land, basically downhill, to a hydroelectric plant that would generate electricity somewhere in the Jordan Valley, which lies much lower than sea level. You would then produce electricity. That electricity would then be used to desalinate some of this salt water. The fresh water would then go into the supply systems of Israel or Jordan or both, and the brine, the very, very salty water that is a byproduct of the desalination plant, would then go down to the Dead Sea. And be used in part to help raise the level of the Dead Sea, which has been dropping quite a bit in the last several decades.
Interesting you mentioned that. What's the story with the water flow of the Jordan River? I mean, why is the Dead Sea, the level deep, going down so much?
The Dead Sea is basically the end of the Jordan River. There's no outflow from the Dead Sea. It's much like Great Salt Lake or Mono Lake. It's a terminal lake, so the only water that it gets is the water that flows into it, and the only water that flows into it is the Jordan River. Over the last several decades, Israel and Jordan have been using more and more of the Jordan River for their domestic uses for agriculture. And basically in the last many several years, last decade or so, very little fresh water has been flowing into the Dead Sea. And of course, it continues to evaporate water, and so the level of the Dead Sea has been dropping quite a bit, probably 20 or 30 meters, 30 or so feet, I'm sorry, 300 feet perhaps, in the last several decades. Actually, 20 meters is about 60 feet. So.
Now, when considering such a project of this size on an engineering level, never mind the political ramifications or the problems as mm-hmm. being an international agreement that would have to be forged, what would be some of the environmental impact concerns that might likely come up? As you mentioned before, this is so hypothetical at this point that many of these concerns haven't even been voiced yet, let alone addressed. But let's voice them for a moment. To dig a canal or a combination of canal and pipeline, just in terms of the terrestrial, the transversing the land itself, what would be some of the environmental concerns that you would advise the engineers to consider?
Well, there's no doubt that from an engineering point of view, such a thing could be built. We know how to build aqueducts and pipelines. But there would be very many different kinds of environmental impacts associated with such a big project. First of all, on the land side, you have to dig the canal, you have to dig the pipeline, you have to basically disrupt a fairly significant amount of land when you do it. You have to build the plants at the other end, you have to build the desalination plant and the hydroelectric plant, which has environmental impacts. Then you have to think about the impacts, the hydrologic impacts. You're either dumping very salty water from the desalination plant, basically the leftover from having taken the salt out of part of the water, either into the Jordan River, which would not be good for the ecosystem of the Jordan, or into the Dead Sea, which wouldn't be much of a problem, since, in fact, the Dead Sea is much saltier than that brine would be. But these sorts of things have to be looked at. I mean, we've just barely begun to think about what precisely the project might look like, much less what the environmental impacts of such a project would be.
If such a project were to move forward, it would become a major test of international cooperation. an opportunity to invent environmental protection laws where currently none exist.
Building international projects often lead to some very severe environmental impacts, in part because there are no international environmental laws. We have a clean water law here in the U.S. We have controls on new projects. But international projects tend to be less well controlled. In part, it depends on where the money for such a big project would come from. If it were international aid money, for example, from the World Bank, we would have to try and make sure that the World Bank looked at the environmental impacts and looked at ways of mitigating the environmental impacts. Each country in the region has their own set of environmental laws, which might or might not apply. Israel's tend to be fairly good, although not in many areas not as good as the United States. They're less strict in Jordan, and enforcement is always a problem. Even in the United States, it's a problem, making sure that the laws you have on the books are enforced. An international project like this, I think, would be very difficult to build in an environmentally sound manner.
You've paid attention to and been involved with many water projects, both domestically, nationally, and internationally. As you look at these proposals, either from the Mediterranean or from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, how does this strike you as the size of the project and its implications?
Before you build a project of this magnitude, I think it's absolutely imperative that you look at other alternatives. Even in the Middle East, even in Israel, for example, which is by many standards a very efficient country, a very water-efficient nation, there are still enormous opportunities for improving water use efficiency, for changing the way water is used in the cities, for changing the way water is used in the agricultural sector, that in my opinion could probably delay the need for such a project at least for many, many years. And at an economic cost and an environmental cost much lower than building such a project.
Would this, if it got built, would this be something that archaeologists, historians, in 2,000-3,000 years from now would look back on the way we look back on some of the water tunnel projects that were of biblical times, and we marvel at what they did? Will this be something that will be marveled at 2,000-3,000 years hence?
Well, it's certainly a big project, although, honestly, by international standards, it's not a huge project. Much bigger projects have been considered in the United States. The California water projects, in their sum, are much bigger than this project would be. The Chinese are building a much bigger project now than this would be. You have to remember that, in fact, the distances in the Middle East are not very large. And so what we're talking about would be a fairly big aqueduct, a fairly big pipeline, a fairly big desalination plant, but bigger ones have been built. And so in that sense, it reaches the scale that you're thinking.
Dr. Peter Glick, Director of Global Environment Programs at the Pacific Institute in Oakland, California. The institute is a nonprofit policy research center studying the implications of global environmental problems for international politics. Glick says it is impossible right now to put a price tag on this project. No route or even specific design has been described yet. Suffice it to say, however, it would be in the billions. In fact, says Glick, an even more vexing problem would be how to establish rates for usage. This new water would be precious and expensive. Who gets to use it? How much? And at what cost? And then, would water become a trading commodity, along with oil? Would we see a water cartel? And would we speak of water tankers carrying barrels of water on the high seas? And with the influx of new water, would it still be the Dead Sea? This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We're glad you joined us. Make a note and tune in again next week for more news on the environment. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. Our thanks this week to production assistant Linda Anderson. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE.